Good morning, Connecticut. To our friends across the Sound, it's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, this morning we're going to open talking about stuff, the stuff you have that you don't want anymore, and the incredible things that Goodwill can do with that stuff, from selling it to underwrite programs that help disabled individuals in our communities, to putting those individuals to work, sorting and merchandising that stuff that you donate in Goodwill stores across the region. Then we're going to chat with a statistician from the Connecticut Economic Resource Center, or CERC, about their latest survey of state residents, gauging how they feel about life, health, and safety issues, and how much of their hard-earned tax dollars should be spent improving life, health, and safety issues for us all. Then, with Connecticut being on track to lose more than 1,000 lives to the opioid epidemic this year, most of those involving the super powerful and deadly drug fentanyl, we're going to speak with a scientist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health who's promoting a new, simple, low-cost test that can help drug users detect whether fentanyl is hidden in their street drug purchases. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this reminder. The Journalism Education Foundation of New England, a division of the New England Newspaper and Press Association, or NEMPA, is awarding up to 10 $1,000 scholarships this spring to high school seniors and college students who aspire to pursue a career in journalism. The scholarship is available to residents of New England. Applicants must be a college student or high school senior planning to attend college the following year to study journalism or a related field. And they are required to have a GPA of 3.0 or above. Interested students can just download a scholarship application by visiting NENPA.com. That's NENPA.com. Well, it's so great to be starting off the program this morning with actual people in the studio and not at the end of the phone. Not that I don't love my phone guests, but it's great when folks are actually here and we can talk, and especially when they're from such an important organization to the award-winning For the People, which is our friends at Goodwill. And I'm so pleased to make the acquaintance of Shayna Holleran, who's here with us in the studio. She's a district manager for Goodwill, and they reached out to our program and our radio stations recently because of the need for stuff. You've got stuff hanging around. You don't want it anymore. Goodwill needs stuff, and they're making it really easy to connect to that stuff that you want to get rid of that they need. So we're going to talk all about that today with Shayna. But first, we want to hear, briefly chatting with her before we went on the air, she kind of made what appears to be a really logical and beneficial transition from big box retail to nonprofit. Shayna, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Welcome. Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you took the experience that you gained working in retail to really boost the great work that Goodwill is doing.
All right. So I work for Goodwill. I'm a district manager there. I travel in between the stores just as offering support to the stores, ensure they have what they need to keep our donors satisfied, our customers satisfied. Working at Walmart, you know, I sold a lot of product. I sold a lot of things. I was able to really see what people need and what people pay for things. So I take that knowledge over to Goodwill and give it even a better deal to our consumers.
We kind of joked that, you know, stuff that you may have ended up actually literally selling to somebody back in that career may actually become before you or your workforce again.
I see a ton of things come through that maybe were this big item, you know, years ago, and then now they come through the doors and it's like, wow, I remember selling this. I remember people waiting in line to buy this item. So it's pretty cool.
That's great. Well, first of all, I guess the most important question to ask is why donate aside from, kind of giving people a place to take stuff that they don't want anymore. Where does it go? Why does it go there? And what does it do once it's there?
Sure. When we accept a donation at Goodwill, we're able to put a value on it, put it on our sales floor and sell it. So one aspect is we have our customers that come in to buy that product. They're getting a great value for that item. So they're paying, you know, half or less of what you would pay for when you go to a regular big box retail store. And then the sale of that item, those proceeds are going to help us support our mission. We're really trying to help people people in the state of Connecticut find work and find jobs. So when you buy an item, we're able to take that money and support our career centers that are out there in our stores to help people find jobs, write resumes, improve on their interviewing skills.
And it's not just programming that you're supporting. There are actual opportunities for these individuals, possibly even to work their very first job at these centers.
Absolutely. And we employ 30 to 50 retail associates in every store that we have. And the store numbers keep on growing and our number of employees keeps on growing.
Tell me a little bit about the morale that you see, because you kind of, you know, you drift around and go from place to place and you can kind of gauge morale in one place versus the other. Whenever I go to a Goodwill store or interact with Goodwill programming, I find most of the folks are pretty upbeat and excited to be there.
Absolutely. You know, it really shows that we love what we do. When you walk in, people are happy, smiling, and you can just tell that we're working for something that's just bigger than ourselves.
Mm. And how about from the customer perspective, bringing in folks like yourself with the kind of experience that you have? I have to imagine organizationally, overall, you may even hear occasionally from customers about how this is just like a shopping experience in a $1 billion big box.
Absolutely. Especially we have a few new stores that we've opened in the past couple of years, and you walk in and it's screaming, you know, the style of the store, the layout of the store. It's like a regular retail store that you would walk into. So our customers are usually really excited about that. You know, we have fitting rooms, we have restrooms, we have well-organized departments.
And the product line is, I know that many people think of Goodwill first when they think of donating things. And there are specific types of items that Goodwill needs more than others. But as you mentioned sort of before, we're not going to really talk about what you don't want, because essentially there's a customer out there for virtually anything somebody may want to get rid of.
Sure. I can't tell you how much I've learned just by being at Goodwill. You see this stuff come in, you have no idea what it is or what it's for, and then you meet that customer that wants to buy it, and they'll tell you exactly what it does and the reason behind it. So you'll find just about anything that you're looking for at a Goodwill.
Yeah. As 10 people are kind of standing there scratching their heads going, what the heck is that? Somebody's walking up behind you, literally breaking into tears because there it is.
Absolutely. That happens all the time.
Great. Well, tell us a little bit. There are things that you would prefer to have, and I guess now kind of post-holiday season when a lot of people may have gotten, especially like housewares and household goods, as a gift, or they decided, oh, they're going to, you know, beef up their microwave or their toaster or their vacuum cleaner, and now they've got the old standby that's now just sitting in a closet, right?
Sure. You know, all the time we'll take clothes, we'll take shoes, we'll take purses. This particular time of the year, and especially now, we're a little short in the houseware section. So we're just looking for, like you mentioned, coffee pots, microwaves, toasters, glassware, dishes. If over the holiday season you've redone your kitchen and you have some things that you don't need anymore, we'd love to have it down at Goodwill. We could really use that hard good stuff.
How about in terms of size or scope? I mean, do you guys actually want to take things like dishwashers and stoves and refrigerators?
Typically, we don't do major appliances.
Oh, okay. So kind of countertop appliances,
yes,
and things like that?
Yes.
Super. Good. Let's talk about how you make it really easy for folks. I heard there's drive-up service.
All of our Goodwill stores and donation centers have drive-thrus. So when you pull up, the folks inside are notified there's a car there. They come out to help you. We usually bring a cart outside to help you unload that product from your car. Real quick and easy, we'll have a receipt ready for you. It's a real simple process.
And how do folks find out where their closest location is?
You can go on our website, gwct.org. We have over 30 places to make a donation, so I'm sure if you live in the northern and western part of the state, you'll find one really close to you.
And we kind of touched upon it, but like, this is really a much more logical and kind of communally beneficial way to deal with stuff that you don't want anymore versus maybe just having a tag sale or something like that.
Absolutely. I always tell people, when you make a donation, it is not ending up in a landfill somewhere. It's ending up in a store to resell. It's likely that maybe your neighbor down the road might be coming in to buy that item that you don't need anymore. So it's ending up back in a household, back in someone's house is maybe their favorite item.
Excellent. Tell us a little bit about how you factor pricing. This stuff is sometimes coming to you virtually, I guess even on occasion, in the box that it may have come in from the store. Maybe it even wasn't used. Other times it's gently used. How do you deal with that in either judging how you're pricing things? You said most things are half or less than they would have to get it in new in retail. Can you talk a little bit about how you gauge that stuff and how you prep stuff that's a little bit more used for the sales floor?
So there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes at Goodwill. When we get a donation in, we're doing our best to make sure it's in sellable condition. So we have a process that we go through, whether it entails a little bit of cleaning and scrubbing to get that product ready for the sales floor. And then when it comes down to pricing, we really have some standard prices that we use in our stores. So if you go from one store to the next, you really should still be able to find that drinking glass for a dollar from one store to the other store. And then, you know, we get our unique items in that, the ones I talked about that you might not know what it is until you've actually used it somewhere in your future. But when we get those items in, we really do our best to put a great value on it. We want to make sure the customers feel the value side of it. And then when it goes out to the floor, we want to make sure it's nice and clean and ready for the consumer.
And does stuff that comes in that may look really in good shape, but you know, once you test it, you find it's not in perfect working order. Do you have the facility to actually kind of refurbish that for the sales floor, or does that unfortunately have to get?
You know what? You'd be surprised how many people are looking for items that for pieces or parts, right?
Oh,
so
I see.
Let's say,
oh,
you know,
yeah,
you have a coffee pot, you're looking for that one piece that maybe broke on yours. So sometimes we will sell something maybe without all the working pieces because we realize there is a market for that, but we're always very clear about it. Hey, you know, you're buying this, but it might be lacking something. So we're always pretty clear. We do plug things in. We have some light bulbs and batteries to test it out and make sure it's in working order for our customers.
No, I never thought of Goodwill as a haven for tinkerers or individuals who service appliances and furnishings and things like that. So that's great. Well, before we wrap up with you, Shana Halloran, tell me a little bit about where people can go and when you accept donations at these various locations across Connecticut.
We have awesome hours in our donation center. So a lot of centers are opened Monday through Saturday from 9 to 7. Our stores really have great hours, our donation centers. Most store locations, you could donate between 8 a.m. and 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday. On Sundays, we're a little bit shorter, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. Again, check out our website, gwct.org. You'll find really specific hours and locations. And we don't require any call ahead or any appointment. Just feel free to drive up. We'll have someone there to help you and come outside to collect your donations.
Excellent. And is there a facility for an individual who may be actually liquidating like an entire estate or an entire home on behalf of maybe a relative who has passed or moved or something, relocated? Is there still some availability for them if they have enough stuff to be able to get it picked up?
We do have that assistance available on our website too. If you went to gwct.org, there is a place there to let us know that it's something larger, an estate sale, a big moving sale, and someone will contact you directly about that kind of pickup.
Excellent. Shana Halloran, our newest friend here at the award-winning For the People. She's district manager for Goodwill. Today, Goodwill of Western and Northern Connecticut has an urgent need for household items. As you heard, furniture, small appliances, glassware, and other wares. When you donate to Goodwill, your items go on to be treasured by someone else, even someone who may want it for parts. And it helps to put people back to work and help those folks who are engaged in Goodwill at the service end of things achieve more independence. We appreciate you guys coming out today. And don't forget, if you have some stuff and you really want to put it to good work in its next life, you can go to gwct.org to get hours and locations, find out about pickups or when you can drop it all off. Thanks, Shana, for being part of the program this morning. All right. Well, in keeping with our sort of loose thematic practice this quarter of talking with individuals, either in the realm of academics or in the realm of statistics, we're pleased to welcome a brand new friend to the award-winning For the People with an organization that's been a regular guest on the program for many, many years. Alyssa DeJong is with us. She is with CERC, the Connecticut Economic Resource Center. She's the Vice President of Research at CERC, and she's also on the board of an agency called InformCT. There's no higher priority for Connecticut residents than assuming the health of state residents when officials decide how to allocate funds in the state budget. The safety of people and property is the next highest priority. All of this according to a brand new statewide survey of Connecticut residents that is being done by InformCT. So we're going to talk a little bit about why CERC is engaging in these now roughly quarterly surveys, what they hope to get out of it, and a little bit about the latest information that they have discovered in their latest survey. So, Alyssa, thank you for joining us on the program.
Thanks for having me, John.
And thanks for making time. I know we put this together rather quickly, and I appreciate you being flexible and being able to make the call this morning. First of all, let's hear a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you became engaged with CERC.
Absolutely. My name is Alyssa DeJean. I'm the Vice President of Research at CERC. And the Connecticut Economic Resource Center is a private nonprofit foundation. We're in central Connecticut. And we are trying to provide data and information and insights to businesses, to clients, to the region, as well as the state, so that they can make informed decisions. You know, whether it's about bringing a development into an area, or maybe there's a policy issue that needs to be discussed. So we're really trying to shed some light on different policy areas, and that's why we came up with this survey.
And I was going to say, it sounds like your resources are equally valuable to businesses as well as municipalities, economic development agencies, either locally or regionally, perhaps even statewide.
Exactly. Yeah, we have a lot of different resources to offer. So one is this information from this quarterly survey that we conduct. There are very few surveys being conducted statewide looking at the residents and their perspective. And so we thought that was that was something that we could fill to bring that information into that larger policy dialogue.
So this is the second of a planned roughly quarterly surveying practice?
We've been doing this quarterly since the beginning of 2015. So we actually have 12 quarters worth of data so far. And we're doing it through our partner organization, InformCT, which is another public-private partnership that's providing information to policymakers.
So their consumer confidence survey is a separate entity, but you utilize either some data gathered for that or collateral to that as part of the CERC survey?
Exactly. So we're using CERC staff, our analysts and researchers, to conduct and to facilitate the survey, and then the information is being released under our partner organization.
Excellent. So just to not bore listeners with a lot of deep in the weeds statistical speak, could you in sort of easy Sunday morning language just explain a little bit about the mechanics of this, how many people were called, how many people responded, and from a kind of scientific statistical perspective, how do you weight the answers so that they are representative of what we're assuming is the entire population?
Right. So, so for people who are interested in listening to the statistics, we did have 510 residents across the state complete this survey. It's online, and that is a representative sample of the state population. And we make sure that we are getting our information from the counties that are more populated. And so we have a larger representation of respondents from Hartford, New Haven, and Fairfield counties than we do the rest of the state. And so that's how we have a statistically significant sample of statewide residents. And so that's why we can draw these conclusions.
Okay. Well, part of the collateral reason why I ask is, you know, hopefully there's a lot of folks either listening indirectly on the air or clicking onto the podcast and hearing this later at some point. Are people across Connecticut, if they are receiving correspondence in the form of either a phone call or an email from CERC or Inform CT, they need to know this is you know, a legitimate entity, and it could play a very important role for them to take a few minutes to respond.
Absolutely. We really hope that people who do get asked to complete our survey will complete it, because it really gives us a lot of valuable information.
Would you be able to reveal whether these folks would be the subject of phone calls or emails or some other type of correspondence?
It's all done through email. It's all an online survey.
Okay, so if people receive an email that may look unfamiliar, but it's either from CERC or Inform CT, Consumer Confidence Survey, these are both legitimate, and it's what we're going to be talking about.
Exactly.
Excellent. Good. Well, getting on then to the meat of the conversation on this latest survey, it appears that, at least according to the Advance, the public is divided on where Connecticut should be spending its taxpayer dollars. So let's talk a little bit about specific points of this and start with business conditions.
Okay, sure. So, with the survey every quarter, we ask the same set of beginning questions, asking about whether respondents think the economy is improving or worsening or maybe staying the same, and then we also ask about some larger business conditions, and then we focus on people's personal financial situation. And then we ask some specific questions that I'm sure we'll talk about later. But we found that, unfortunately, people are not that optimistic about the state's economy right now. Only 20% agree that the economy is improving. And that's a much lower percentage than what we were seeing last year and the year before.
Is there any indication as to whether or not they're expressing that based on their own personal experience, or more about, you know, what they're seeing from the individuals with the loudest megaphones, either whether it's in the media or on social networks?
Right. So that's a great question. It seems that it is more of a larger perspective that people are responding to, because when we ask folks about their own personal financial situation, about half are saying that their situation is about the same as it was 6 months ago, and you know, people are feeling generally kind of better off about where they were than 6 months ago. But in terms of the kind of the overall state of the economy, overall business conditions, they're not feeling as confident about that.
So from the prompts that are here in front of me, only about 3 out of 10, which is the lowest percentage in 3 years, are concerned that their jobs or their partner's jobs are in jeopardy. And at the same time, more than twice as many people believe their personal financial situation is going to be better in 6 months than it is during the period of the survey.
Right. So when we see that, you know, folks are feeling that there are, you know, some jobs but not enough, or you know, we did see that 63% of the respondents believe that there are some jobs but they're not quite enough. You know, that's showing that you know, people are feeling somewhat confident about their own situation. You know, only 31% are concerned that their own job or their partner's job is in jeopardy, and so that that bodes well for things to come. We saw that we're also seeing that more than two-thirds say that they plan to take a vacation outside of Connecticut over the next several months. We're also seeing a good percentage of folks planning to make a major consumer expenditure, you know, either furniture or maybe a car or something like that. So we're seeing some good signs about, you know, people and what they plan to spend. They actually are planning to make some purchases in the near future.
And that a lot of that has to do with the security that they're feeling about their own job and or their spouses.
Exactly.
Excellent. Folks, if you're just tuning in, we're having an important conversation with a new friend of ours, Alyssa DeJong. She is the Vice President of Research at the Connecticut Economic Resource Center, CERC. She's also on the board of Inform Connecticut, which is a partner in putting together now a roughly quarterly survey of Connecticut residents to help inform businesses and decision makers with the state, again, facing a certain deficit in the current fiscal year, the state legislative session that just convened, and the recommendations of special commissions established to examine the state's fiscal stability and prospects for economic growth, which are due on March 1st. The findings that we're talking about today point to the public's priorities for the allocation of state resources. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more with Alyssa about this right after a quick break. We've got about 7 or 8 more minutes with her to cover some more specifics of this survey. It's all about what you're thinking. Let's see how close to what you are actually thinking was reflected in the survey. We'll be right back. Stick with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The 14th annual Courage to Speak, Empowering Youth to be Drug-Free Family Night is coming up on March 13th at 5:30 at the Rotom Middle School in Norwalk. Our friend Ginger Katz continues to build this free event each year to bring students and parents together to talk openly and honestly about the dangers of drugs and to help students become outstanding anti-drug advocates and mentors for their friends and younger siblings, with the goal of eradicating drug use among young people across the country. To register for this free family night or learn how Ginger Katz can bring her Courage to Speak presentation to your school or community, visit CourageToSpeak.org. Thanks for sticking with us. Alyssa DeJong is with us. She is the Vice President of Research at CERC, the Connecticut Economic Resource Center, and works also on the board with Inform CT, who CERC partners with to draw data from the Inform CT Consumer Confidence Surveys. We're specifically talking about data that was gathered in the fourth quarter of 2017 for their latest survey of state residents. So, Alyssa, thanks for sticking with us here. So, according to the information in the survey, 55% or about half of state residents indicate that assuring the health of themselves and their families was a top priority. Let's talk a little bit more deeply about that and how that reflection could actually end up influencing a potential legislature or changes in existing legislation in the State House session this spring.
Sure, absolutely. So you know, before the break, we talked about some of the standard questions that we asked during the survey. But then at the end of our survey, we always want to ask some sort of timely question, and we change it each quarter. And so talking about the budget, we thought was something that was really important so that we could get this information to legislators, because they're, of course, you know, continuing to deal with our budget situation. And we thought it would be a good idea to ask state residents what they thought, spending priorities are for the budget. And as you mentioned, John, we found that 55% of our respondents said that assuring the health of themselves and their families was a really top priority for them. Isn't that interesting information now for legislators to have when they're thinking about spending priorities for the state budget, knowing this input from residents as to their top priority for spending you know, could be very helpful.
Very good. Let's move on to student achievement, which is something that is probably becomes much more acute right about now when the 169 municipalities, and some of which are engaged in multi-jurisdictional school districts, mm-hmm. are all sure. sitting down and mulling their 2018-19 budget requests to taxpayers.
Exactly. So we found that, you know, 27% of our respondents thought that state spending in this area, the maintaining the high student achievement in the K-12 schools, was one of their top two priorities. We also found that the same percentage placed it as one of their two lowest priorities. And so I think that's, you know, that reflects the population, the age of our state's population. So it is very important to kind of maintain these really excellent schools that we have, but we also have a lot of competing priorities with a number of different populations and age groups in our state. And so we have to keep that in mind when figuring out how to balance the budget.
And so does this statistic suggest to you as a statistician and involved in the science yourself, does this suggest that people think that generally the school district that's serving their community or their children, those school districts are doing a pretty good to really good job, and maybe it's time to look at other avenues to share the wealth?
Sure. I mean, that's a great question, and I can't make a conclusion based on this question, but we did ask in our previous quarter survey about regionalizing services mm-hmm. and whether folks thought that was a good idea, and it was an overwhelming positive response across all the different types of services that we posed in, you know, in terms of, you know, do you think these types of services should be regionalized in terms of health and safety and schools and things like that, and we've got an overwhelming response that residents are interested in thinking of considering regionalization options and thinking about what that means for the budget.
Very good. Another area where there was an apparent split on was spending over Connecticut's most vulnerable populations.
Right. And so we found that, more than a quarter of our respondents thought that should be one of the two highest priorities. We had about the same percentage thinking it was one of their two lowest priorities. I think what's happening is because we gave them six options and asked them to rate from highest to lowest what we thought their spending priority should be. Since we had such overwhelming response that health should be the top spending priority, followed by the safety of people and property, I think that these other two that had a more of a polarized outcome, where you had some people thinking they were really important, but then others thinking less so, just because the other ones were the health and safety were just top of mind to them.
Okay. The other interesting point is that you even asked a question about the quality of productivity in the workforce. I would think that most people might think that is something that is gauged more based on things going on at the federal level than the state level, but I guess it all rolls downhill, right?
You know, it does, and I think that's why that ranking was kind of somewhere in the middle. To me, it shows that respondents maybe don't think that that's something that the state needs to focus its efforts on as much. Because you're right, John. It could be either a federal issue or it could be a private sector issue.
And sadly, coincidental that we're leaving the environment to last, because that seems exactly where Connecticut residents apparently think spending priority should be.
Exactly. I mean, I guess if you're asked to, if you're asked to prioritize health and safety versus the environment, unfortunately, the environment came up a bit short in our survey.
Very good. Well, are the machinations for survey number 8 in place and getting ready to roll out for the next quarter?
Yes. Yeah, we'll be having the survey in the field in the coming weeks. Yes.
Great. So once again, if people have just kind of started tuning in to the broadcast and process, could you just remind them of who they might be seeing emails from and why it's so important for them to actually click on that and consider responding?
Absolutely. Yeah, so this is a survey conducted by Inform CT with the help of the Connecticut Economic Resource Center. And it's a quarterly survey of residents across the state. And we're getting people's opinions on an overall confidence in the state economy, in their personal financial situation, and then also asking to provide some insights on different policy areas. So it's the information is very helpful for us to provide to state policymakers so that they know what state residents are thinking.
Excellent. Alyssa DeJong is our newest acquaintance here at the award-winning For the People. She is the VP of Research at the Connecticut Economic Resource Center, or CERC, and on the board with Inform CT, who, as you heard, may be tapping you via email to participate in this important consumer confidence survey and consumer surveying that they are doing, not only for Inform Connecticut's own purposes, but also to share with organizations like CERC. We hope folks will consider participating because active participants will end up making a difference, as you're hearing, in the possible influence of state policy and spending. Alyssa, great to speak with you. Thank you so much for your information this morning, and we'll talk to you again in about 3 months. So really happy to be wrapping up the program today with a really important subject. When I get an email that asks me to share an impactful story that features new research identifying a low-tech tool that can be used to prevent fentanyl deaths, I stand up and take notice, and I'm so pleased to make the acquaintance of our guest this morning, Dr. Susan Sherman, who is with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. She worked on a project along with Brown University in partnership with the Bloomberg American Health Initiative in a report that was just recently released identifying a simple low-cost test that may help drug users detect whether fentanyl is hidden in their street drug purchases. I'm so glad we're able to talk with you this morning, Dr. Sherman. Thanks for being part of the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's talk about kind of the overarching issue here, which is really the development of what you kind of classify as a harm reduction tool and why that's
right.
So often misunderstood.
Well, just to define, you know, harm reduction really is a way, it's creating conditions of possibilities that prevent harm in the midst of an environment that maximizes harm. So the unique piece about harm reduction is that it reduces the harm of drugs. It doesn't talk about drug users as harmful or demonize drug users. It acknowledges that since the beginning of time, there have been drugs, there will be drugs, and it's not to say that it's not about promoting drug use, it's about promoting the health of drug users, people that use drugs. It really is about meeting people where they are in a way with dignity and respect and not thinking about people as harmful.
Where does the misconception or the misunderstandings come in and create stigmas and sort of misdirect the truth?
Good questions. You know, it's hard. It's hard to be, I think we have a hard time, and we're kind of unique in many ways, this country, and with other Western industrialized countries, and developing countries as well. But there's a lot of judgment around drug use that doesn't exist in other places, in Europe, in Australia, where it is more considered, it's not about being a moral failing, it's considered a fact of life that you then deal with in terms of having appropriate scaled-up drug treatment, having services for people who inject drugs like syringe exchange, having sufficient, you know, methadone and buprenorphine and not having regulations that make it hard for people to access that, so which is a part of drug treatment, having fentanyl and drug checking, which has been available for 30 years in Europe, fairly standard in their public health programs. But for whatever reason, I mean, not for whatever reason, we're a country that was kind of born from the Puritans, and we have morality tied up in lots of things we considered vices, and it really gets in the way of good public health and public policy programming and laws. And this overdose epidemic, which, you know, in my city has been happening for a long time, not these numbers, but, you know, it's been happening before the doctors were prescribing the pills and pharmaceutical companies were marketing to primary care providers to prescribe more pills. Before that, you know, people have been dying of overdoses, and there just isn't this kind of will to acknowledge that people need help and should have opportunities to stay healthy and safe through all of their drug use continuum. We rather focus on people that, you know, 90% of people at all times are out of treatment compared to 10% in treatment. And scaling up great treatment is a part of that, but it's not the only, it doesn't solve the issue. And now that we have, it's dizzying the numbers of people that are dying now. So anyway, it's a long answer to say, we just don't seem to have, if you think about this as moral failures, why would you want to help someone that you think is morally flawed or failed?
And you're so well traveled and have seen so much in other countries compared to the United States. Are you seeing or currently hearing from colleagues worldwide that the entry of fentanyl into the world of opioids and into the lives of opioid users, is the U.S. on par with other nations?
No. It's much further ahead. I mean, people are dropping like flies here. You know, in my state of Maryland, 5 people die a day. The numbers that you gave for Connecticut, you pick many states, West Virginia, Ohio, my home state of Kentucky. I mean, it's just pretty phenomenal. It's much higher in the U.S. than other places and much higher in certain parts of the U.S. than other parts. And that has to do with the drug supply and the way that, you know, heroin, for example, on the East Coast is a powder, and on the West Coast it comes in black tar, which is harder to adulterate with a powder like fentanyl, although it's begun to show up in heroin in the West Coast and also in other drugs. So we are very far ahead of any other country in terms of if fentanyl induced these kind of crazy rates of people dying.
As you corrected me before we went on the air, the carfentanil, which is exponentially more powerful, is now beginning to show up more and more. As I indicated before the program, emergency services workers, law enforcement, firefighters, who are now more increasingly responding to calls as EMS support, they have to be extremely careful about exposure, not just to fentanyl, but to this incredibly potent carfentanil.
Right. It is. I mean, it's incredibly potent. It's an elephant tranquilizer. So you can only imagine how much of a drug, the potency of a substance that's needed to tranquilize an elephant. And that is what carfentanil was designed. That's its intention. So it's a really powerful drug. It's, you know, 50 to 100 times more powerful than fentanyl, which is 50 to 100 times more powerful than morphine. And there have been reports where even first responders have touched carfentanil and, you know, they've overdosed themselves. So in our market here, it's an unfortunate thing. People do, pardon me, have information about the drug supply, but we're not talking about a regulated market, which is why, you know, you and I right now are talking about drug checking and the importance of drug checking and having that information in the hands of people who are most affected in real time, and that is people who use drugs. Because we don't know what are in drugs that come into the market, and drugs are now getting adulterated by the substance that is cheap. It's a synthetic opioid, cheap to produce. It's a cheap filler. It largely comes from China. As interdiction gets stronger, you need smaller quantities with higher potency. So, there are a confluence of really bad factors that have led to where we are now today with the types of drugs that we have and where their overdoses are occurring and why there's been an increase in the number of people who are using these drugs first legally and then illegally. So anyway, it's complicated.
Very good. We're speaking with Dr. Susan Sherman, a professor in the Department of Health, Behavior, and Society at Johns Hopkins University. We are recently contacted as a result of a brand new low-tech tool that can identify and prevent fentanyl deaths to the extent we are experiencing those deaths here in Connecticut. This is something that has come none too soon. As a means of getting into the conversation about that research and the development of this new product, Dr. Sherman, you are co-leading the addiction and overdose work group at the Bloomberg American Health Initiative. Just give us a quick little orientation about the great work that the Bloomberg Initiative is doing.
Well, the Bloomberg American Health Initiative, actually, it was a large gift from Michael Bloomberg in honor of our centennial at Hopkins, 100 years of the School of Public Health existing. And he really was interested in bending the curve of mortality. When he was mayor of New York, life expectancy increased by 2 years, and so he and experts came up with his philanthropies as well as at my School of Public Health came up with 5 focus areas that would be the focus of this American Health Initiative to help increase life expectancy. And they are nutrition and food systems, the environment, violence, adolescence, and addiction and overdose. And so the program is largely training master's and public health students. There, when fully scaled up, there'll be 50 MPH students every year with a stipend. And the unique thing about the program is that it's not just an individual applying. They need to be working at an organization, and the organization applies as well of sorts. So it's supposed to really develop this cadre of expertise in the nonprofit and community-based organization world. There also is research that gets funded that goes through an application process like the one that we're talking about today, our forecast study, and then it also enhances teaching. So it's practice, teaching, and education, teaching, training, practice, and research.
Excellent.
So that's the initiative.
So speaking of the research, let's get into talking about a little bit about the results when drug testing technologies were studied for their ability to detect fentanyl under this Bloomberg initiative.
Right. So we tested, the study had 3 components. One was talking to people who use drugs. One was in 3 cities, Baltimore, Boston, and Rhode Island, Providence. One was talking to service providers where drug checking could occur. And then the third was a lab component where we actually tested the efficacy and of 3 testing modalities that were designed not for public health settings, but to see how they would fare in public health settings, 3 different technologies. The first technology were these fentanyl testing strips, which are small strips of paper that have an immunoassay on the top of them, and within 3 to 5 minutes, with minimal training, you can see a positive result, which is 1 stripe, versus a negative result, which would be 2 stripes. And we found that these were very highly sensitive, which means that if the drug was present, they could detect the presence of the drug. We also found that they were very high in terms of they were specific. So if the drug was not there, they did not say that it was positive. So we found them, of the 3 methods that we tested, to be the highest in terms of sensitivity and specificity. They also were able to detect the smallest amount of drugs present. So it's kind of how low do you go when you keep introducing smaller and smaller amounts? Is it able? Does it get picked up? And so we found these strips in 104 samples, half positive, half negative, actually 208 samples, because we had 2 labs that participated, one in the Baltimore City Police Crime Lab and the Rhode Island Crime Lab. We measured this and the other 2 technologies against the gold standard, which is a very expensive mass spec machine that's used to process drugs for criminal purposes. Mm-hmm. So these strips are fast, they're easy to read, they're easy to hand out, they don't look like anything nefarious if someone has them on them. They're kind of the size of a coffee stir, you know, that thin wood piece of coffee stir, but half as long as that. And they're $1 a piece. And they were, the way that they tested them was to dissolve part of the drug sample, which actually happened to be street seized drugs that were in small quantity, like what someone would use, so it wasn't from big busts, and it was dissolved in water, and that's how it could be used. It's approved in Canada to be actually for urine testing, but we wanted to try something that was even more low barrier, which would be dissolving a tiny amount, whether it be from a baggie or residue in a cooker where people cook up heroin. To test the drug. So that is who thought I'd have so much to say about a tiny strip.
Well, it sounds like you know, you definitely covered all the bases, and it's very exciting to hear that you were able to benefit from being able to get literally the drugs to use for testing almost off the street within days or maybe even hours of when people were actually out there buying it.
Well, I don't know about days or hours. I mean, that wasn't one of our criteria, but in relatively real time, and they were real samples. Yeah. So it, you know, which is important because, like we talked about a little bit earlier, the drug supply is so unknown, and you can't really make it up. So the fact that it, you know, it's important. That's why we wanted to have three different cities. We wanted in general, but two different crime labs that drew substances from these different localities. I will say that, you know, the strips, everyone with this study has really kind of grabbed on to the strips, and they are extremely useful for multiple purposes. One, it's a way that, I mean, we ask people, drug users, people who use drugs, where would you want these strips to be handed out? And overwhelmingly, needle exchange, health centers, safe consumption spaces, homeless shelters, drug treatment programs, and it's the way that you can engage people in a conversation. You don't just hand them out to someone without talking to them. It's a way to say, like, you know, fentanyl could be in your drugs. How do you think about fentanyl being in your drugs? What are the things that you've done? Here's something that you can use, and always remember to use with other people around you and to make sure you have enough naloxone, which reverses the effects of an overdose, et cetera. So it really is a good, inexpensive, relatively speaking, tool of engagement. But in some markets where there's 90%, 70%, 100% fentanyl, it wouldn't be the most useful because people presume that all the drugs that they consume have fentanyl.
Okay. Well, Dr. Sherman, I would assume in the last couple minutes that we have, one of the really important factors is that as public health agencies begin to think about drug checking to address fentanyl and using the product that we're talking about today and handing that out and making that available or making sure the people they serve who are consumers of the drugs know that these test strips are available, it also creates yet another opportunity to possibly connect these people with addiction treatment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I just want to give a pitch for one of the other devices that we tested.
Sure.
I promise I'll describe it more quickly. It's called the Bruker Alpha. It's the size of a cash register. We only tested it in one lab, and we found it to be fairly good at discerning that a drug was present and even better to say the drug wasn't present. And the reason that it's useful, it's the kind of machine that's used in a fixed testing site throughout Europe. It is because it's $20,000, so it's expensive, and you have to be trained to read the output. It basically develops a library tailored to a given location, and it can read multiple drugs, so it's not just yes, no, which is, you know, the fentanyl testing strip. People would like to know how much, right? Not just yes, no, but also, like, well, what percentage? Mm-hmm. And the Bruker Alpha can not only tell a number of substances that are in a given substance, the full spectrum of substances in a substance if they're in the library, but also the percentage of the concentration relative to the others. So that's also a machine that could be used if someone were trained. Obviously, it would need to be there would need to be legal allowance for that to occur, but that's something that's useful in a different, as opposed to handing out the strips, a fixed site.
Very good. And the assumption then in this last couple moments that we have with you is that the availability of either the test strip technology or this gauging device that's around the size of a, as you said, a cash register, is connecting people with resources that can hopefully convince them to seek treatment, which I guess would be the optimal end result.
I mean, I think really, I would just say that, you know, the opposite, someone said this, the opposite of addiction is connection. It's not sobriety. So connecting with people, connecting with services, connecting with hope, making informed decisions about what they do. And I will just say that 90% of the people that we interviewed, 335 people who use drugs in Boston, Providence, and Baltimore were interested in drug checking and felt that it could reduce the risk of overdose. Most people did not seek fentanyl. That's a common kind of misunderstanding. And for those that did, 75% did not seek fentanyl. The 25% that did likely were younger, and they likely were used to fentanyl only because that's what's in their drug supply. So people who use drugs don't want to die every day that they wake up. They actually want to, the language is they want to get well. Yeah. They don't want to be sick, because being dope sick, you know, your brain is really on fire for the receptors in your brain to receive an opioid when you're addicted. And so people don't want to die in that process. So we found that people were very interested in these kinds of devices. And we hope that this work, as well as others that's occurred, will help realize that, because every year we should just be ashamed of ourselves if there are evidence-based tools in our toolkit that we're not using them as people die.
Good way to wrap things up, and a good last word from you, Dr. Susan Sherman, who's worked with the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and Brown University in partnership with the Bloomberg American Health Initiative. Their recent report identifies both the simple low-cost test as well as other devices that can help drug users detect whether fentanyl is hidden in their street drug purchases. Thank you so much for your great work. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make a request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours in the New Haven area at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford, and for our Hartford stations at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Vocat, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. Don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab at our radio station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.